Funding for this talk comes from TrialX, connecting patients to clinical trials.
I'm Priya Menon, scientific media editor at PureTalk. And along with the PureTalk team of Sharib Khan and Chintan Patel, I welcome all of you this afternoon to a discussion on prostate cancer. As always, we'll be moderating the call and bringing people live on the show. As we all know, Cure Panel Talk Show is organized by PureTalk, the blog of TrialX.com, an online platform to connect patients to clinical trials of new treatments. For information on clinical trials for all conditions, please visit TrialX.com/ask. This is the 13th episode of the Cure Panel Talk Show, and the second time we are discussing prostate cancer on this platform. We are excited to announce that all prostate cancer panels on Cure Panel Talk Show are conducted in association with the Prostate Cancer Foundation and the Prostate Cancer International. On today's show, we are honored to welcome renowned prostate cancer expert Dr. Mark Rubin from V. Cornell Medical College. Dr. Mark Rubin is a practicing genitourinary pathologist. The focus of Dr. Rubin's laboratory-based research for over past 10 years has been the development of molecular prostate cancer biomarkers to distinguish the indolent from aggressive disease. Dr. Rubin holds multiple patents for molecular biomarkers and is member of the World Health Organization's Prostate Cancer Tumor Classification and Cancer Genome Atlas Advisory Groups. Welcome to the show, Dr. Rubin. On the panel, we have prostate cancer survivor, Paul Henschel. He is calling in from Indonesia. Paul is keeping me company today. I believe it's about 3 a.m. there in Indonesia. And here in India, it's 1:30 a.m. Morning, Paul. Paul is working on the development of a foundation for disabled and otherwise compromised children in Indonesia. He is part of the Prostate Cancer Canada Network, Brampton. We also have Jim Bigstrom with us. He's prostate cancer survivor, patient ambassador, athlete, and writer. Unfortunately, Dan Zenka and Dan Hennessy is not able to join us today on the panel. Dan Zenka has come up with a family emergency, and there has been a death in the family for Dan Hennessy, so I'm afraid they're not able to make it today. Now, before we begin the discussion, I would like to read a couple of rules. People who are listening in to the panel through the phone as well as the computer, please mute or stop the online broadcast on your computer for better audio quality. Callers will be invited to ask questions at the end of the discussion. They can let us know by pressing 1 on the keypads, and we'll bring them live on air. I now invite Dr. Rubin to speak. Dr. Rubin, you're on air.
Hello. Yes.
Dr. Rubin. Yeah. Yes.
Yeah. Yes. Hi. So
welcome
thank you
to
very
the
much.
Show, Dr. Rubin.
Oh well, thank you very much for having me. So I wanted to make a few comments about advanced prostate cancer today, some general comments, and then maybe some specific comments about an aggressive type of prostate cancer called neuroendocrine prostate cancer. And I'll take 5 minutes. Is that a good, okay amount of time? I don't want to speak too long.
Yes. No. We can have actually 15 minutes, doctor. No
problem. Okay. Okay, great. So,
Yes.
So I'd like to just start by saying that in the area of prostate cancer, things have, and you're probably aware from the previous discussions, that things have really changed over the past 5 years. We've seen the introduction of a number of new drugs that in the United States have passed the FDA and are now being used for first-line metastatic prostate cancer as well as second-line, meaning that individuals who present or have developed advanced prostate cancer now have a number of agents that they can select for with their clinicians to begin treatment. And as we've known for a long time, one of the main approaches that's being used is to try to decrease the levels of androgen, circulating androgen. And that's using anti-androgen therapies, and there are a number of therapies that are available with these new drugs. They have two approaches. One is that they block all of the production of the male hormone, and that's a drug class such as abiraterone, which you may have heard of. The other type of drug directly blocks the androgen receptor, which is the receptor that's the part of the cell that is stimulated by male hormones. So there are two drug classes that have been developed, and a lot of the therapies now work in a way that's very similar to therapies that have been developed before, but the main difference is that they are much more effective. So they bind much more effectively to the androgen receptor. They lower the levels of androgen, or the male hormone, to very, very low levels, so that the effect is that the tumor cells cannot grow as they had in the past, even when we were giving similar types of drugs, but they weren't quite as strong. So the good news, I think, is that we are in a phase where there are really is a wide selection of drugs. They're really targeting at doses that are tolerated to have very, very potent effects on the androgen or the male hormone pathway. Now, one of the emerging problems that we're seeing is that there's resistance, and there's a number of ways that resistance can occur, and that's obviously a very important issue for men and their families with advanced prostate cancer. And one of the common mechanisms is that the androgen receptor itself may undergo a mutation or some change so that the drug is no longer binding effectively. And there are some recent studies from Memorial Sloan Kettering, from Charles Sawyer's group at Memorial Sloan Kettering and others, suggesting that in that event, one could perhaps switch to another drug that no longer is resistant to that mutation. So that's one approach. What I'd like to just focus on for just the rest of my discussion portion is the other aspect that I think is important is that sometimes when the tumor cells become resistant, they become even more virulent or more aggressive, and they transform into what's called neuroendocrine prostate cancer. This is a very aggressive form of prostate cancer, and we believe it's due to the effects of these potent anti-androgen drugs that are being used. And it doesn't occur in all men. It occurs in some men, and we know that the clinicians, the doctors, can observe that in this individual, their PSA or prostate-specific antigen levels may go down. They also may have disease that extends to their organs as opposed to going to the bone. So it presents clinically different than when patients have recurrence of the normal type of prostate cancer. And we're encouraged by studies that occurred in our lab and some other labs now that are suggesting that there are alternate ways now to treat these types of tumors. And that has to do with the fact that we've observed that these tumors, these neuroendocrine tumors, overexpress two genes that we think are highly targetable. They're called Aurora kinase A, and the other gene is called NMIC. And both of those genes have a property that they bind to each other, and they prevent the NMIC gene from being degraded. And so we're using a new drug class that targets that interaction, and we believe that we're hopefully in the trial that just opened here and at multiple other sites, we are going to be able to determine whether this will be a way to treat men who have resistance but to this highly virulent type or aggressive type of prostate cancer. And this is an insight that we think is important because as we start treating men with these new drugs, we have to also be careful that if we are seeing the course of the disease change, that we're aware of it and that we can recognize how to treat it correctly. So that's a quick overview of what I wanted to mention. I just wanted to add one other thing, and that is that in conjunction with the Prostate Cancer Foundation and Stand Up to Cancer, our group, as well as other groups from Memorial, University of Michigan, Dana-Farber Cancer Institute, University of Washington, and the Royal Marsden, are working to develop what we refer to as precision medicine care for men with castration-resistant prostate cancer. And what we're trying to do is each individual man who's on the trial, we're performing sequencing, molecular sequencing of their tumors, and trying to learn why they respond well or don't respond to treatment. And so I just wanted to introduce that at the end, because I think that's an exciting new approach that will help inform us in the future the best way to treat prostate cancer when it's in the advanced setting. So I think that's pretty much what I wanted to cover today, and then I hopefully this will encourage some good discussion.
Thank you, Dr. Rubin. Moving on to the panelists. Paul, would you like to introduce yourself and tell us your experience with prostate cancer?
Yes. Hello, Priya. Hello, Dr.
Paul,
Rubin. Can you hear me all right?
Yeah.
Can you hear me now? Very good, very good.
Yeah.
Hello, Dr. Rubin, and Priya, and Dan. And greetings from Indonesia, of all places, at 3 o'clock in the morning. And, yes, I was, I guess, a long, easy approach, if one can say such things, to my diagnosis of prostate cancer. At the age of 50, my doctor started me on PSA testing. And it wasn't until I was in my early 60s that I tipped the magic number of 3.5 and started seeing a urologist. It was shortly thereafter that it started climbing a little more rapidly. And when I reached about 7.5, I decided for myself that I would have a biopsy and was positive. I then had to make a choice between surgery, which my urologist would be quite happy to do. But he also suggested that because my Gleason was 3+3, I was about 7.5 on the PSA and T1 on the biopsy, that I might want to explore radiation in a new format that was being done at Sunnybrook Hospital, University of Toronto, which I actually did opt for. It's hypofractionated accelerated radiation, where I had 7 units, 7 grays, only 5 doses. My urologist there, oncologist there, Dr. Andrew Loblaw, has discovered that the harder you hit it initially with his approach, the better the results. And that was 5.5 years ago now. I did a voluntary biopsy 2 years ago, after 3 years, and it was totally negative. Now, I do have a sort of a wry sense of humor, and what I suggest with that is that's kind of like going to court. They never find you innocent. They only find you not guilty. So currently, I consider myself to be cancer-free and very fortunate. That's my story.
Thank you, Paul. Jim, please tell us about yourself.
Did you say Jim?
Jim, yeah. Yeah?
Yeah, okay. Well,
hi,
hello. Before I start, if you're a new prostate cancer patient, I would just like to suggest people check out places like Yana Now, run by Terry. You are not alone. It's a fabulous resource that allows people to interview and actually connect with people who have had all modalities of treatment, good and bad, and see their experiences. And Terry is an active surveillance kind of person. And also, Mike, who runs the new Prostate Cancer Infolink, has been a great resource also. a place you can also ask questions for perspective. You'll need to get a lot of Googling done on that one because the abstracts coming across are quite challenging. If you don't understand the lexicon, which, of course, nobody does, coming into the steep learning curve. Having said that, for many prostate cancer patients, it's like looking at a glass ceiling. You can see the surgeons up there and the radiation oncologists up there, but connecting the dots is very challenging. And it's almost like a prism to people when they first are diagnosed. I was diagnosed on April of 2011, and I had a PSA of 565, Gleason 3+3, but I had 9 out of 12 cores positive, so I really wasn't a good candidate for active surveillance. So I was in Kaiser, organized kind of a managed healthcare system at the time, and they told me on the phone I had cancer. I had no clue if I was going to die in a year or a month. They didn't tell me. So I go to see their nurse who handles all of the choices you're allowed before you see the doctor again. And, you know, they go through looking at cryo, active surveillance, a variety of radiations, the surgery. And they kind of look at me and it's like, which one do you like? And as a patient, you couldn't believe it. I'm thinking, are you kidding? Which one? You know, we're not really capable of making these choices. So I went on a major research mission, and I started reading National Library of Medicine, which to me was, again, a steep learning curve because I kind of challenged by the lexicon. And if you read any abstracts, you know what I'm talking about. Just trying to figure out where this is going when you read an abstract is really difficult for somebody who is challenged by the lexicon again. I went on Medscape for hours, but what really was most elucidating for me was I began interviewing prostate cancer patients of radiation, of robotic surgery, and that's where I learned everything because old guys do not hold back. They just tell you this. They'll tell you what they believe. And there are some that are really happy, and there are some that are fighting angry because of what has their experience been. And they felt like the side effects, for example, were underexplained. And they felt like the radiation doctor who owns a radiation machine is selling radiation. And they find that some of the surgeons who prescribe, RALP, also that's what they do. So the credibility of some urologists has been skewed dramatically as a perception from prostate cancer patients. And again, that's been my experience, but I talked to a whole lot of people who have the exact same one. And I'm not sure how urologists think they're viewed by the public, but patients are really consumers now. We're just not patients. We are consumers. And the ACA will really open that one up once it becomes law next year. But looking at all the choices, I had a hard time because when I was doing my research, I went into Kaiser and I said, you know, what is this HIFU thing? And which is what I did. And the doctor I talked with, who I feel is very confident, his body language completely closes up. He crosses his legs and he rolls the paper in his hand into the size of a straw. And he tells me this horror story about HIFU, which is high-intensity focused ultrasound. And he tells me this horror story that was dated, 10 years old. And I was kind of troubled by that because I said, well, what is your current data? He's got nothing. But he's winging it on telling me what is wrong with it. So I decided to leave Kaiser, and I went to United Healthcare, and I went to see Dr. Kane in La Jolla, California. Dr. Kane is chief urologist for UCSD Moores Cancer Center, and probably Dr. Rubin even knows him. And if I was doing surgery, I would use him in a heartbeat. He's fabulous. But he basically told me that he could only spare 50 or 60% of my nerve bundle, meaning I'm probably going to be wearing pads the rest of my life. And that was not my best choice there. So I asked him about HIFU, and he basically said, HIFU will never be approved in the U.S. Well, he didn't know. I've already interviewed the biomed engineer for the FDA's HIFU project, and I've already interviewed the lead proctor for HIFU for the FDA. So I kind of had a little background, and I said, can I see your current data? And what was troubling to me was he had no current data. He'd never witnessed one. He'd never done one, yet he has an opinion on it. So that kind of pushed my button along the way here. And I went into further research. I interviewed more patients of all modalities again. And ultimately, I was trying to find out, if I'm going to do HIFU, where do you do it? You know, you can do it all over the country. You can do it in the world, but it's outside our U.S. borders. A gentleman in Japan that has fabulous results, apparently. There's a guy in Belgium who people are happy with who uses Ablatherm. After my research, I chose Stephen Ciante out of Boston, only because he just seemed very experienced. And when I figured this all out, no matter what you do, whether it be radiation or you do Ralph or you do HIFU, you want the most experienced guy you can find. You don't want the guy that's done dozens. You want the guy that's done hundreds. And Stephen Ciante, for me, was that guy. He gave me a cell number. When I called him, he picks up, if that tells you anything. And he picked up more than once. And I couldn't even talk. I couldn't make an appointment with my urologist here in San Diego area. And yet I got a guy in Boston who will answer his phone and answer all my questions in real time. So that was significant for me. My HIFU experience went fabulous. We went to Bermuda. They use a Sonablade 500, which now apparently is MRI-guided from what I read from the AUA conference 2 weeks ago. But I can't rave about it enough. It was international HIFU I used, and I'm a pretty critical guy, but everything was perfect, from the nursing chair to the hospital stay.
Thank you, Jim. Thank you. We'll move on to the questions now. Paul, maybe you want to ask Dr. Rubin your questions.
Yes, I'm back on the air.
Paul, you may ask Rubin. Yeah.
Yes, okay. Yeah. Yes. The first question, my questions, basically all three of them, focus more on the after-treatment aspect. And my first question is that tremendous funds are being assigned to research causes and cures, but how much consideration is being put towards the situation of those of us who have made our choices and have consequences to deal with, such as incontinence and impotence?
Paul, this, you know, obviously is something that is being studied, but I would just make a general comment, which is that I think both patients and researchers would all be happy if there were more funds available because for the activity of research, because we're all sort of struggling right now to identify funds to do the important research. So the type of research that you're talking about is really may be termed quality of life. It may be looking at outcomes of procedures. And I think we heard in what I thought was very important discussion from it was Jim, right, who spoke before, that we can hear about a whole series of events that go through the patient's trials and tribulations once they've been treated, and perhaps even before, when they may not be fully informed about all the potential complications. So I think it brings up a very important point, which is that obviously once you've been treated, there is work that is related to quality of life and trying to follow that. And it really probably often should start before, in other words, getting an idea of what the patient's expectations are. And that clearly understanding, you know, what the risks are of the procedure. So that one of the general problems that was brought out in this what I think is very good discussion of early disease is that patients with a newly diagnosed localized prostate cancer have so many choices. And as we heard, we are often being asked as patients to make our own decisions, or we're being guided by individuals who I think what was pointed out was that may have some interest in the procedure that they're doing over other procedures, and you know, that's of concern. The biggest problem in the research setting, I would say, is that we do not have clinical studies where we compare one approach to another approach that is often done in other settings. And the reason for that is it's been very difficult to get these studies designed where people would be willing to participate. For example, surgery versus active surveillance or surgery versus radiation. It's really, we don't have enough data to say which is the best approach. And for that, it also, I think it's important to recognize that when looking at how patients do and trying to study that, we're also at a disadvantage because we don't know if patients have been selected, let's say for surgery, differently than they have been for radiation or for HIFU or other things that were mentioned. And so, you know, I think there probably isn't sufficient funds, and there could be more funds allocated towards this, especially given the considerations that we're not sure how much localized therapy benefit all men. Clearly, they benefit men, but not all men are benefiting the same, and perhaps when you weigh in the complications, one would maybe consider active surveillance over treatment. So I think it brings up an important issue, and you know, it represents an area that's clearly underfunded and understudied. And I do think, and I heard very loudly the concept that and the reality that people don't fully appreciate all of the complications they may be facing. Maybe it wasn't explained well, or maybe it wasn't patients were given alternatives to consider. So I think those are really important areas that need to be further studied, and we just don't have, I don't think, enough going on in that area. So I would agree with you, that's an important area.
Yeah, if I could just add a comment. Jim mentioned that people like myself and him are probably the tremendous resource. However, we walk a tightrope between giving our opinions about our treatments and the after effects and so forth, and not stepping into the realm of giving medical advice. And that's a very tricky, tricky point.
Yes.
Patients, we basically tell them to ask your doctor. We basically explain, I tell them I'd like active surveillance if I could have. So for me, you know, it's...
Jim, you may please ask your questions. I think we lost you for a few seconds there. Please ask your questions to Dr. Rubin.
Well, I have two questions.
Please ask your question to Dr. Rubin.
My two questions I've posted already here, one is kind of answered about why there is no comparative analysis between radiation and RALP, for example. Part of the issue I have is you can go to an individual doctor, and I can go to a restaurant right now and find out the caloric intake of the food I'm eating, but I can't easily, from one urologist, find out the data, his personal data, on how many of his patients he recommends radiation versus RALP, on how many of his patients have come out with side effects, what percent. I understand side effects are underreported by patients, but what are his percentages? What percent of recurrence does he have? And I'd like to see it on paper if I'm a patient. I don't want to hear it told to me. And I don't think patients are capable or have a collection of questions to ask that doctor they go to. Either you're really lucky that you go to a doctor who looks at all modalities for you, or you're unlucky to have one who is somewhat biased and is not good at active surveillance working with you because his caseload is too strong. So I guess my question's already been answered there, but I'm really troubled that I can't find professional data easily online in this kind of 2013 of each urologist to see their successes and failures and to see how they operate, and pun intended. It is really troubling to a patient, and I've heard now this from dozens of patients in my uninformed way to approach it.
Mm-hmm. Well, I think, I don't have too much to add to that. I think you're right. I mean, you're looking at it at the individual doctor level, but even more broadly, we, as I mentioned before, we do not have the studies in localized disease to really help answer this question. So clearly, this is an important issue, and I think it's for the public, it's very important because it represents both important issues related to how patients are treated as well as how our healthcare funds are being allocated, and we really want to make sure that we're allocating them in the best way to most effectively take care of patients. So it is of concern that there's no standard way of evaluating our procedures, and that's of concern.
Paul, please proceed with your questions.
Yes. All right. My second question, the preamble, basically. Essentially, we as survivors are your best source of feedback to assess the effectiveness of treatments, and that, of course, ties to what Jim was saying. The difficulty I always have when doing the follow-up questionnaires when I go for my 3 months, 6 months, whatever, is sorting out which aches and pains I may have felt since the last discussion with my oncologist, which are treatment-related, which might be just part of the fact that I'll be 69, in a couple of weeks, which are notable, I should be making a little note, gee, I had that. What are triggered just by fears of undiscovered after effects? So my question is, how can we develop a better symbiotic relationship between doctor and patient in a more global sense to provide the vital feedback that might just make all the difference in making the next steps?
Yeah, I mean, I think that being in the medical profession, often we'll think about this in terms of tests and advances in various imaging or things that might help diagnose at the earliest time a recurrent tumor or to ensure that things are going well. But I think you've brought up another issue, which is how does a patient's self-assessment and assessment of symptoms, how well is that heard, and how much time clinicians have to sort of address that? So I think that's a very important point. I think we tend to focus a little bit more on how we can measure it in some molecular way or some imaging manner. I would say that in the setting that you just described, it really is important. I think if you see something that's very different, feel something that's very different, that would be conveyed. But some of the points you make are, there are some areas, gray areas, that it will definitely be harder for interpretation. So often what we do is we want to see how individuals change over time, and that might be the only way to get at. So I don't really have a good way of answering, except I do think it's as you point out, it's a partnership, and that both parties need to be listening carefully, particularly the clinician listening to what the patient's saying, because real changes may indicate something. In addition to types of, for example, screening for PSA or doing some routine imaging that may be required in certain settings, and then that's related to disease recurrence, and then certainly in the area of the complications or issues related to those complications. That also is an important discussion, and seeing how things improve over time after the surgery. So these are all, you know, issues related to communication that are very important, but sometimes a little bit hard to measure or to formulate how one does that.
If I can supplement on that too, I feel I'm in a very different setting due to the Canadian healthcare system, where my major concern when I went in was that they were really cheap and only putting $8 worth of gold seeds in my prostate instead of something a little fancier. Whereas in the United States, where it's very much a more of a business model for healthcare, I send my oncologist emails all the time. He responds all the time. We have a tremendous relationship that way. When I go to talk, I'm never under a time pressure. I never feel like I'm part of a business. And I wonder how that plays into this also.
Yes, I mean,
would like to add something. Yes, Jim?
What did you ask? What did you ask me?
Would you like to add something, Jim?
Well, you know...
Would you like to add something?
Yeah, I understand. Again, it's almost random. In my experience so far, it's almost random of the doctor you go see. For so many patients across the United States, you can be in Mississippi and have the greatest urologist who's totally into what your thing is, and you're going to get great care. But again, the workload for some urologists in some areas, there's one urologist for a community that's fairly large, and you don't get the care. They don't have the time. And that's an issue that, you know, Paul, you sound like you're pretty lucky. I would add one more thing. When cancer patients are identified first on, when you first find out, you almost need a 3x5 card, a bunch of cards that tell you, here's the procedure, here's what can happen to you. And there's a website, My Prostate Cancer Treatment, has got a bunch of lists where if you do a robotic surgery, well, here's the outcomes that you can have, you know, and it tells you. But one of them is like a loss of bladder control. A lot of guys in America don't quite get that. So if you had a blue-collar version that has the doctor say, and I'm saying this in a different way, if the doctor says, if I suck at doing what I'm doing in this surgery, you're going to be buying diapers for the next $400 worth of diapers the next 20 years, that will hit home. And I'm saying it overtly on purpose because so many patients don't understand that part, the side effect. And that's what's troubling, which, Paul, you obviously didn't have that issue, but there are patients who have regret, and they're on Yana now. You can read their own, their story. And that's what I would like to add to it. I just wanted people to be up front for the patients.
Thank you, Jim. We'll open up the discussion for our audience now. Callers who want to ask a question to our panel, please press 1 on your keypads and we'll bring you live on air. Callers who would like to make... Yeah, we have a caller online. Yes, the person calling in from 914-772, please ask your question.
Oh, hi, thank you. First of all, this is very informative and interesting. I've read a lot about Dr. Rubin's work, and I've been very impressed. My husband was diagnosed in, I believe, 2004 at a pretty young age. He's 55. He'll be 55 next month. And because of the side effects all the men are describing, he had put off the surgery until 2010. He had it done at Sloan Kettering, and excuse me. And at that point, the Gleason was, I think, 9. His PSA was only up to about 20, I think. A couple months after that, he still had a little bit of a PSA, which obviously he shouldn't have had after the surgery. I think it was up to about 4. And they subsequently found one bone met in the rib. So that's what we're dealing with now, which is, I guess, still considered advanced, even though he has the prostate out. He was on hormones for about a year, And then it started kind of creeping back up to 0.33. Okay. It got up to about 4, and now he's on Zytiga, which has now pushed it down a bit. My question is, because what I've read about it is that ultimately that will stop working too at some point, even though it's a great new drug. I've read a lot of Dr. Rubin's work with genetics and things like that, and I guess my question is, could there be a time that the tumors in the bone could be tested for certain mutations, and then a drug could be matched to that mutation to stop the cancer growth? I guess that's my question, or any other suggestions that you may or may not have.
Yeah, so that's actually a very important point that you bring up regarding your husband's history, and I think where we're focused. So one of the areas of great interest for the research community now in this area is to try to learn and understand as much as we can in the setting that you're describing. So we know that we can treat for a while, but at some point the tumors become resistant. And so I described the Stand Up to Cancer Prostate Cancer Foundation clinical trial. It's open at Memorial Sloan Kettering, and as I mentioned, and some other sites. And that would be for an individual who has metastatic disease, is being treated with abiraterone or the Zytiga that you mentioned, or some other first-line agents. And they would then, if medically stable, would elect to have a biopsy of their metastatic site. And at that time point, that tissue would be used not in the normal way, which would just be to look under a microscope, but then actually to look under a genetic microscope and then to do sequencing. And we are hoping that type of sequencing will lead to information as to what would be the next best drug and the next best treatment for the individual. I would say at the outset one has to be very cautious, because we do not know that will in fact be the case. It may be that the genomics will be informative but not helpful. Informative in the sense that we might learn something about the biology of the tumor, but at that moment in time we won't have drugs on the shelf to be able to treat that patient. So, you know, I do think there are opportunities to, what I would see as, partner with a research-oriented trial and then hopefully use that to gain some insight. But I do caution, and I you know, think that although we're optimistic, we do want to caution that, you know, we could not guarantee that that's genomics will lead to the next drug that you need. But that is something that's available at multiple sites. So.
Okay, thank you, Doctor.
Sure.
I'd just like to remind the callers that if you press 1 on your keypad, if you want to ask a question to a panel, please press 1 on your keypad and we'll bring you live on air. Dr. Rubin, I have some questions that participants have mailed to me. First one, Alan wants to know, how often does standard transrectal ultrasound biopsy understage prostate cancer? He wants to know, is saturation biopsy more accurate?
Yes, so the question really has to do with sampling. And in general, what we found is over the years that there's always going to be a sampling issue. I mean, sampling, just by definition, what it is a estimate of what the real thing looks like. The real thing being the prostate gland and what is the amount of cancer that is in the gland. So we've moved more recently to multiple biopsies. So biopsies around 18 biopsies is not uncommon. The term saturation biopsies is one where one performs many, many biopsies, even far beyond 18, and that would be in a setting where a patient might have elevated PSA, slightly elevated PSA, but no detectable cancer using standard biopsy approaches. So I think it's really tailored toward the individual. If you have a normal set of biopsies, which can range anywhere now from usually 12 to 18 or 19, then that would be usually sufficient to sample and then determine if somebody has a cancer or not. But if they are still suspicious, sometimes they will go to a saturation biopsy. And those can be as many, I mean, they could be up to 100 biopsies, and that's actually quite extreme, but people have done that.
Thank you, Dr. Rubin. We have a caller online. A person calling in from 914-806. Please ask your question.
Hi, Dr. Rubin. I had a question for you. My dad had radiation, and then he had hormone therapy. His PSA number is low, so far he has just been going for his yearly visits. I just wanted to follow up regarding the girl that called in about her husband. How often do you think someone should go for PET scans? Even though his number is low, it is, the doctor considered it advanced because it's in the lymph nodes. So, but he just has to go every year for, he goes to a hospital in New York, and the doctor follows up every year with him. He was diagnosed, his last radiation treatment was in May 2011.
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, there's a normal standard of care, and it may not include PET scan. I don't know, you know, what the routine is for the physicians there at the hospital. I wouldn't recommend one thing over another. I think that's something that there are several modalities for following advanced disease. There's many new imaging approaches. So that would, I think, the specifics of your father's case, I couldn't really comment on beyond saying that, you know, if they're following the PSA, they are seeing him on a regular basis, that would be, you know, part of the normal care. I think a little bit different from what we were hearing earlier about the discussion about localized disease, I do think there is a reasonably good consistent approach to following patients in this setting and looking carefully for recurrence. You know, so I don't necessarily know, or would, I could say that you definitely need to have a PET scan, but follow, the clinical follow-up is obviously very important.
So the what do you think? He goes to Sloan, but mm-hmm. think about the removal of the lymph nodes, or that depends on each doctor's recommendation.
Okay, so just to clarify, so you're saying that he is still on hormones?
He stopped the hormones, so he's not.
But
on
he
hormones
has,
right
but
now.
He has, but he has lymph nodes that are considered positive.
Correct.
In other words, having, well, then, because I know that institution, and I do know that institution is one that is very advanced when it comes to imaging, meaning that in whether it's a PET scan or whether it's a scan that uses a molecular marker, they do follow patients quite closely. So, you know, you know, asking a question that I think I'd have to know more information, but I would say that, you know, related to the institution, it's really the one of the places where they would be, you know, closely monitoring with this sort of state-of-the-art imaging. So I think you'd be in good hands there, as long as there's no progression of disease. So and that's what they'd be monitoring. So.
Okay. Thank you.
Okay.
Thank you. Thank you, Doctor. Dr. Rubin, Jeff, one of our participants, wants to know, how long will it take to have a clinically accepted genomic or biomarker for the aggressive prostate cancer?
Yeah, so that's a great question. The group, the community has been working on this for a long time, and I think there are a number of challenges. And so the National Cancer Institute has, you know, definitely provided sufficient funds for us to look at this. So on one end of the disease, we heard earlier about men who are diagnosed with localized disease and then are being followed. Often it takes many, many years to understand what really happens with their disease, as many as 30 or 40 years after initial diagnosis. So that's been one of the challenges, to come up with a biomarker that might tell us how that patient will proceed. And so those biomarkers have been challenging, and we've been involved in that, and you know, we've developed some genomic biomarkers that we're hoping are going to be useful in the localized setting, but again, that's a challenging area. And there's some new biomarkers that have been recently released. One is by Genomic Health, one is by Myriad Genetics, and it really, we have to see with time how useful they will be. The other aspect is in men with advanced disease, and I think we are making good progress there in trying to understand what are the genetic changes, and those would be types of molecular studies we do that tell us that the disease is going to progress more rapidly. And I gave one example in my overview discussion about this aggressive neuroendocrine cancer, where we've recently developed an assay that if you're positive, we believe that you're more likely to then progress to that disease. And those are the types of observations that also need validation. So we need to do more studies to confirm that. So I think we're unfortunately still in the early phases of biomarkers for disease progression and also for risk. So it's a very good question and something people are working on actively. And the government, the NCI, is National Cancer Institute in the United States, is very supportive of this type of research.
Thomas asks, is a cure of metastatic castrate-resistant prostate cancer, Gleason 8, being pursued by any successful tactics other than hormone therapy? And which are the most likely to get to human trials in the next 5 or 10 years?
Okay, so if I understood the question, it's with, are there other treatments beside hormone therapy for metastatic disease? Is that? Okay. So there are a number of strategies for treating metastatic prostate cancer. The most common is hormonal, but there are also chemotherapies that are used. So docetaxel is one of the drugs that's commonly used. There's also radiation. So there's actually a newly approved drug that is the basis of it is radium-223, so it's a alpha emitter, very strong, very potent emitter of radioactivity, and that was just recently approved by the FDA in the United States, called radium-223. And so those are two examples of non-hormonal treatments for advanced or metastatic prostate cancer.
Okay. George says that he has had an increasing PSA over the past 4 years, initial 6 to now 15.4. He has had no family history, 57. He says he'll be scheduling his appointment for a biopsy. He wants to know why there is a continued increase in PSA.
And the number you said was 15.4?
0.4, yeah.
But I'm sorry, but 15.4?
15.4, yeah.
Okay, yeah. So I think that brings up a very important point. So prostate-specific antigen is the screening test that is used. We've heard a lot about it in the news because it's prostate-specific, but it's not prostate cancer-specific. So there are a number of reasons why PSA can be elevated. A patient could have inflammation There could be trauma, some sort of damage to the prostate. There could be there could also be cancer. So there are various reasons why the PSA could be elevated. And one important feature is that sometimes if there's a very rapid increase in PSA, sometimes we'll watch it. It'll be watched for a month or so to see if it goes back down. It could be just due to an infection or something due to inflammation. But at 15.5, if 15.4, if there's a biopsy is performed, could also be due to cancer, and that would be one of the things that the biopsy would be used for, to rule out the possibility that there's cancer. So, you know, there are other things that can explain elevated PSA.
Bob wants to know that he has been on active surveillance for 8 years. He wants to know, is there anything more in the pipeline to tell if the efficacy of my decision is correct? His urologist and oncologist supports his decision, but he wants to know if he's right.
Okay. Well, that's Bob, right? So I don't want to sound as if I'm making a product advertisement, because I'm not here to do that. But I would just point out that at the very recent American Urologic Association meeting, the Genomic Health, and you could look at that on the internet, Genomic Health, has introduced a test for individuals who are considering active surveillance and they have a biopsy. And the test is supposed to help gauge whether they're at high risk of a disease progression. Now, if you've been on active surveillance for a number of years and you've had a number of biopsies and they all remain to be a low Gleason grade and PSA doesn't change, those are all good signs. But I just am, as a means of information, I'm just saying that there is this test there. It's relatively new. It's not been tested over long periods of time. And, you know, so we can't vouch for how well it works, but I just would point out there is such a test if one really is of great concern, and this may be useful. But again, I don't want to, it's not a product advertisement, and certainly the clinician may not be aware of it because it's so new, so don't be too upset if they don't, but maybe just point them in the direction, let them read about that and inform themselves as well.
Thank you, Dr. Rubin. We have a couple of more minutes. Paul, would you like to ask Dr. Rubin anything else? Paul, you're on air. Jim, would you like to ask Dr. Rubin anything?
I'm impressed as heck at just the advancements. I know that they're significant for metastatic cancers. I have a friend on Firmagen. And boy, the challenges for him when he takes this medication is challenging, as you know. And are most of the new hormonal therapies invasive to the body, where people have a difficult time functioning, or are they making progress where there's less, I don't know how to say it, but it affects the patient less to be effective?
Right. So I think one of the things I mentioned in the introduction was that the drugs are more potent or more effective. By being more effective, one of the goals would be that you potentially could lower the doses because they're effective, more effective, and also probably more effective at a lower dose. So that hopefully that would play some part of the of reducing symptoms. There are, you know, new drugs being developed that hopefully reduce side effects, and so that's always a consideration in the introduction of the newer hormonal drugs. But at the end of the day, you're removing a hormone, and there are side effects of that, which clearly, you know, you can't entirely get rid of. So they're trying to reduce them, but can't be entirely obviated. So,
thank you.
Sure.
I think that's all. Thank you, Jim. That's all we have time for. It was a wonderful discussion. Dr. Rubin, thank you so very much. It was an honor to have you here today. Paul and Jim, you are wonderful. Thank you so very much. Your talk thanks all its listeners and participants. Thank you all for your support, and we look forward to having all of you join us for the next Cure Panel Talk Show. For more details of upcoming shows, please visit trialx.com/curetalk. The link for today's broadcast will be made available on CureTalk within 24 hours and will be sent personally to all participants, panelists, and experts. Thank you so very much. It was great having you here. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Thanks.
Good night. Bye now.